This is Nahumi, Sefer Shemuel Bet, chapter 14. Yoav, David's general, realizes that David is still pining and thinking about his son Avshalom, who is still in exile in Geshur. Unwilling to confront or advise him directly about the matter, Yoav devises a roundabout strategy to bring the issue to the attention of David and kind of force his hand to resolve it. Yoav approaches a wise woman from Tekoa and asks her to present a fictitious legal case to the king that he hopes will serve as a kind of a metaphor or parable to direct the king towards a resolution of the problems that are plaguing him. The woman disguises herself as a mourner and explains to David that she's a widow with two sons. The children got involved in a dispute of their own, and one of her sons killed his brother. The family now wants to put her only remaining son, the murderer, to death. This would leave the mother bereft not only of her husband, but of both of her children. It would not only cause her tremendous suffering, but would also erase any vestige of her late husband's memory by taking away his only surviving heir. At first, David recommends that the woman go home and says he'll take care of the problem. This vague kind of promise does not satisfy her. She's not willing to settle, and therefore she wants some more immediate action. David then suggests that she bring anyone who attempts to hurt her to the court, and he will take care of it. Again, this is not enough. This is not a reasonable solution for a helpless widow. How is she going to bring anybody into court? So finally, David swears that he will not permit any harm to come to her surviving son, despite the fact that he committed murder. At this point, the woman draws an analogy between her circumstances and those of the king himself. Like the widow, David has lost one son, Amnon, to murder by Avshalom. Nevertheless, punishing the killer would mean tremendous suffering for David, who would now have lost two sons. And condemning Avshalom to a permanent state of exile, banishing him from the kingdom, and cutting all ties with him is equivalent to executing him. It means he's not a part of David's life anymore. He's as good as dead. David now realizes that the woman had a hidden agenda with her whole story and demands to know whether Yoav was behind the whole production. The woman confirms his suspicions and acknowledges that Yoav did indeed put her up to it. David accepts the advice of Yoav and orders him to return Avshalom from Geshur to Jerusalem. However, David refuses to meet with Avshalom face to face. Now, the text interjects here just something about Avshalom, that he was a very handsome guy. He had three sons and one daughter, and that his beautiful long hair would be cut only once a year, and that it was a very heavy head of hair. The text goes so far as to say that he was perfect from head to toe. He's probably the handsomest man we ever read about in all of Tanakh. The significance of this description here is unclear, and there are several possible reasons for it. One is that it's telling us why David was so attached to Avshalom. His amazing good looks made him an ideal heir to the throne. David saw in the looks, in the beauty of Avshalom, something very positive, something very promising. Another possibility, and this would explain why he felt that he had to bring him back. He had to restore him to Jerusalem despite his transgression. Another possibility is that this handsomeness of Avshalom accounts for some of his rash and immature behavior. Avshalom, like Yosef, who was also very good-looking and successful and, so to speak, spoiled by his parents, Avshalom has a bit of an exaggerated sense of self, just like Yosef did, and it can get him into trouble. A third possibility, endorsed by the Radak, is that the text is giving us a foreshadowing of what it was about Avshalom that attracted so many supporters when he tried to overthrow David. But that doesn't exactly explain why it's in our chapter. It should really be in the next chapter if it's about the rebellion of Avshalom. Either way, it's not exactly clear what this description of Avshalom's looks is doing in our chapter. Avshalom is continually summoning Yoav to arrange an audience for him with his father, but Yoav ignores his requests and does not appear. Eventually, Avshalom directs his servants to set fire to Yoav's barley field, and this prompts Yoav to show up very angry at Avshalom's house. Avshalom demands that Yoav tell David that he would have been better off remaining in Geshur. If the king wants Avshalom to be in Jerusalem, he should at least be willing to see him, and if not, if he wants to kill him because he deserves to die, then he should kill him. Leaving him in a state of limbo is not fair. Yoav convinces David to allow Avshalom to visit him at the palace. Avshalom appears before David. He bows down. David kisses his son, indicating a kind of official pardon for the crime that was committed. On an emotional level, reading the chapter leaves us confused. I think that this effect is deliberate. On one hand, we can sympathize with the argument of the woman from Tekoa, and we can also understand the sentiments of David. We can understand that he wants to reconcile with his son. On the other hand, we're conflicted about the propriety of welcoming back this cold-blooded, calculated killer. We see later that Avshalom's immature and aggressive behavior is not only limited to burning down Yoav's fields, but will extend much further than that. And recognizing him as this kind of person who's capable of a lot of violent actions should have made David a little bit hesitant. We can understand why it would make him hesitant. Now, from a religious perspective, that's from an emotional perspective, we can feel the conflict. Do you welcome the troubled child back, regardless of the problems that he may bring to the table, or do you keep him at a distance in order to avoid those problems? On the other hand, from a religious perspective, we see here the further downfall of David HaMelech. His constant consultation with Hashem, whether via the prophets or the Urim V'Tumim, was the signature of his Torah-based approach to governance. Now we see no sign of that anymore. He's following his emotions, allowing them to be swayed by Yoav or by the woman from Tekoa. He's reaching decisions that are inconsistent with his core values. The David of the past would not have hesitated to reject, spurn, and even execute Avshalom for the premeditated murder of his brother. In the past, David had no compunction about holding others accountable for their misdeeds, even when the outcomes of those deeds were of potential benefit to him. Here we see David capitulating to his sentimental side, listening to his heart, and showing preferential treatment to his own child in a way that contravenes the principles of justice that should have been guiding him. From David's conduct, we can already sense that he too was aware of the inner conflict that plagued him, and he was struggling with it. First, he left Avshalom in exile and just wished for him, thought of him. Then he brings him back to Yerushalayim but won't meet with him. Finally, he reunites with him, but in a kind of cordial, very formal way, not with the kind of emotion that we would normally expect. He's restraining himself because he's conflicted. We cannot avoid comparing the errors of David here to the earlier mistakes of his predecessor Shaul. Indeed, one of Shaul's first missteps was in sparing the life of Yehonatan, his own son, because of the pressure exerted upon him by the people. And here we find David following a similar path. Undoubtedly, the text is suggesting to us that David has lost a substantial amount of the religious clarity and focus that he once had, and that once defined his leadership. As we will see in chapters to come, this reintroduction of Avshalom into the picture will ultimately bring much suffering and punishment in its wake. And fingers can only be pointed at David, who should not have allowed himself to be swayed by the sentimental rhetoric of Yoav against his better judgment. As is often the case in Tanakh, those who suffer pain or who experience hardship bring it upon themselves one way or another.